We are about to have lecture four, which is the fourth of the four lectures exactly on the topic of the philosophy of social science. And what's kind of interesting today is there are three lectures today. This lecture, which will include some material on the idea of social identities, and then some material on different approaches to the philosophy of social science. So that's one set of topics. We will then turn to the final lecture on analytical Marxism, on the theory of social class, which is nicely related to the topic of social identities. And then finally, third lecture, China Studies, will take a kind of quick tour of some theories of peasant rebellion and peasant mobilization. Now, what's interesting about this is all three lectures have to do with peasant consciousness, peasant identity, peasant politics, peasant collective action. It's kind of a happy coincidence, in other words, that even though these lectures come from three different series of thought, they all kind of hang together. So let's begin with the material that we did not get to last time, which is on the subject of identity. So what is an identity? What I'm talking about here is a social identity, how a person identifies himself or herself as a person and as a member of a group. And so it might be an ethnic identity, for example. I identify myself as an Irish American, or I identify myself as a Jewish American, or I identify myself as a Han Chinese, or possibly I identify myself as a minority people of China. In other words, a social identity is a concrete social reality. It is embodied in the individual's assumptions about himself, his affinities with other people, and his dispositions to behavior. It includes things like a moral framework. It includes things like a social ideology, possibly affinities and allegiances, the loyalty which I have to some people but not to other people. I may be loyal to other Irish Americans but may not care at all about other Italian Americans. So that affinity is a part of a social identity. It may have to do with emotions. When I see an Irish American suffering, I may feel great pain. Whereas when I'm more indifferent to another person or another nationality. So as a beginning, we can say that a social identity is a set of self-understandings, norms, and ideas possessed by a person that hang together in a cluster within a group at a time. In other words, it's not purely individual. It is that a group of people share a lot of those components of identity. And I think you could give me many examples from China of groups within China which have a shared set of ideas and frameworks and loyalties which distinguish them from other people in China. Hi, folks. Now, one of the things which is important about a social identity is the fact that individuals may come to behave, they may come to have dispositions to behave as a result of their social identity. In other words, we spent quite a bit of time last time talking about rational choice theory, and to some extent, identity theory is a qualification to rational choice theory, because it puts it forward that there are motivations, there are pieces of behavior which derive from these more complicated affinities and emotional realities of the individual, which have to do with his or her membership in a group. At the individual level, we could say that an identity is something that we acquire over time, that we have learned through our development process to have a certain set of religious ideas, a certain set of practices about how we deal with other people, a certain set of assumptions about the way that the world works. But here's, I think, a very important point about identities. It is that they are not fixed once and for all over all the people who have that identity. In other words, it's not true in my country that all Jewish people think in exactly the same way. It's not that all Christian people think in exactly the same way. It's not that all black people have a racially defined identity, that they all think in the same way. Instead, as social scientists, I think we and you need to be thinking of social identities as being very plastic and changeable across people and across a region. And so the task of kind of mapping out the nature of the social identity through a group of people, we should not think of that as, let us find the essential Han identity or the essential Jewish identity, but rather let us look at the group who identify themselves as Han or Jewish, and then look at the both the common elements and the different elements which obtain across that group. And furthermore, so that talks about change of identity throughout a group, all of whom have that one identity, but we can also recognize that identities change over time. That what it is to be a Jewish person in the United States in 1920 is very different from being a Jewish person in the United States in the year 2000. Not only have the circumstances changed, but the moral ideas, the assumptions, the way that one thinks about him or herself, all of those things have changed as well. A really important example that people in the United States are spending a lot of time on is on homosexual identities. The ways that homosexual people identify themselves, think about themselves, express themselves. And the point that is often made is that kind of ideational way of identifying oneself within the homosexual community has changed very much over 100 years. So that homosexual culture of 1990 is very different from gay culture of 1920, let's say. In other words, that's a good example of watching how an identity changes over time. Women's identities, likewise, there's a tremendous amount of interest in the United States about what are the factors which go into forming a woman's self-consciousness as a woman, and how does that change over time? In other words, gendered identity, sex identity, race identity, all of these are both important socially, but also very changeable over time. At the group level, then, there are significant variations in each of these identity formations across the group and across time. The identity is variable across the group, it is also variable across time, and yet, it is not totally variable. So that it is reasonable enough, it is fair enough to try to identify what are some of those common elements of gay identity today or homosexual identity today, of women's identity in the United States. How can that women's identity be contrasted to Chinese women's identity or African women's identity? In other words, there's enough there to allow us to get our hands on analysis and discovery through social science research. And the point that I would like to make is that these factors are socially important. They're socially important, and that means they can figure in social explanations. So that if we wish to explain demographic patterns, for example, in South Africa, if we wish to explain the fertility rate and the rate at which families are formed and so forth, it is one of the variables that we may need to turn to is an analysis of how women think of themselves, how they think of their involvement in the world of agriculture and business, and that set of kind of self-definitions as women has demographic consequences. Well, that would be a social argument, it would be a causal argument, and it would be an argument which turns on our being able to identify some of these elements of identity. So this is the point, that identities are in fact, I believe, social causal factors. But as I have been very emphatic in arguing for the last, all the time we've been together, it is incumbent upon us. It is necessary for us to provide micro foundations for the way that this causal factor works. And so now we've got something really powerful that we can dig into. We can do field work, and we can do interviews, and we can do oral histories in order to try to map out the main components of an identity throughout a group of people, looking both for the common features of that identity, but also the ways in which it differs. Maybe in the United States, rural women have an identity that is an American female identity, but in some important ways, it's different from the urban female identity. Likewise, northern black people may have a culture and they have a set of values and ideas that are characteristic of African American people in the United States, but which are different in some ways from the ideas and values of African American people in the South. In other words, this is a very tangible and concrete form of social investigation, and from my point of view, it is a perfectly legitimate form of social inquiry. I insist on this point because there are some social scientists who say the only things that we can really investigate are things which we can directly quantify and measure. And I would disagree with that idea because I would say that, or maybe I would agree with it, but say identity features are in fact observable. We can do interviews, we can watch social practices, and we can notice the variation of identity features, moral ideas, family values, etc. We can kind of map or plot those differences across time and place. Likewise, though, we have, you know, once we've taken the idea of micro foundations seriously, once we've taken the idea that any social factor requires that we be able to say something about the material and social circumstances at the level of individuals through which that factor is embodied, we are then directly led to this research question, how is a social identity created and reproduced? How is it? What are those mechanisms through which gay people come to have certain styles of dress, certain ways of interacting with other people, certain sexual identities? How is it that they come to have those ideas and those values and those practices? How is it that African American people come to have a certain set of ideas about life and business and family and city and so forth? What are those social influences which lead to the construction of an identity? I would say that is to ask the question, what is the nature of the micro foundations of social identities? And we could answer the question, it's very kind of logical how we would answer the question, because an identity is the result of a personal series of experiences. It doesn't come from nowhere. It is rather, I'm born into a family, I have friendships, I have school relationships, I have ordinary interactions on the street, and features of my kind of life characteristics interact with those elements. And so if I am homosexual, or if I am female, or if I am African American, people then treat me in a way which is coded by that characteristic, and so they begin to teach me, I begin to interact with them, and we could say my social identity is developed. So specific institutions like educational institutions, socialization in the family, normal processes of maturation, these are perfectly understandable ways in which social identities get created and reproduced. Okay, I wanted to be sure that we got to this topic of social identities for a couple of reasons. One, it's the topic is very relevant to the rest of today's lectures, but secondly, our interest here in this class is how to do social science research. What are some of the big questions that need to be considered as we formulate social science research objectives? And I wanted to put it forward that examination of subjective factors like consciousness and values and social identities, that those factors are in fact susceptible to social science research. We could come to have some pretty good understanding of the way that ethnic identities in China are distributed and changing over time. And secondly, they are causally active. Populations who have a set of values, we can then work out some causal explanations on the basis of how people with those values would in fact behave. So here we're making a segue to a second major topic. The rest of today's lectures is kind of picking up on three different large questions in the philosophy of social science that we have not yet talked about very much. The first of those large questions is the relationship between the micro level and the macro level, which sometimes also corresponds to the difference. I laugh a little bit because this is a hot controversy in the United States, but a little bit it corresponds to the difference between qualitative research and quantitative research. You might say that. But generally, the question is, what's the relationship between micro and macro social analysis? So macro social is analysis or social activity at the level of high-level social structures, things like social class, the state, the economic system, the marketing system, possibly the way that a social identity works nationwide. That would be macro social. Micro social is at the level of individuals in concrete social relationships. And if we were just thinking logically, which is kind of a good thing to do, we would recognize that, of course, social activity is composed of individuals in concrete social relationships. Whatever is happening at the high level, it is somehow embodied through the activity of individuals in concrete social relationships. But the question here is, what is the relationship between macro-social and micro-social analysis, explanation, and structure? And there are a handful of positions, and I've referred to some of these in the last several days. One position is reductionism. It's a position that says that whenever we refer to something at a high level, we must be prepared to reduce those statements to statements about the lower level. And so, for example, if we are thinking of psychology, and if we're thinking of brain activity and thought, so thought is embodied in brain activity, thought is the high level, brain activity is the low level, reductionism says statements about thought must be reducible to statements about brain activity. The analogy for the social sciences would be to say statements about large-scale structures and entities must be reducible to statements about individual level activity. That's one possible view. I am critically skeptical of that view, and we'll talk about it a little bit more in a minute. Another thought is, it's called supervenience theory. It is to say, yes, there is a relationship between the macro-social and the micro-social, and that relationship is essentially that the facts about the micro-level ultimately fix the facts about the macro level. So what that does say is that there is something like a determining relationship between the lower level and the higher level. But supervenience theory says reductionism is in fact not possible, that there isn't a neat relationship, that more or less all we can say is facts at the lower level determine or fix facts at the higher level. That is called supervenience. We would say the facts of the macro-social supervene upon facts at the lower level. The What I have favored, and you've seen this especially in the last lecture, is the theory of micro foundations, which says macro social phenomena must be associated with a theory or a statement about what the micro foundations of those high-level processes are. So if we were to say, for example, industrialization in China, that's a macro phenomenon, is causing social unrest in the countryside, those are both macro states, or macro characteristics. Industrial development in China, social unrest in the countryside. What the micro foundations theory requires is we be able to say how industrial development influences people in specific circumstances, which then leads to various forms of mobilization and unrest, which then aggregates to social unrest in the countryside. In other words, the microfoundation theory requires that we be able to show how the high-level factor can be broken down into facts about the local level. Methodological individualism is a form of reductionism. It says that all social statements must be paraphrased in terms of statements about the individual. Now we turn to a couple of theories which are anti-individualist, holism and structuralism. And some social scientists have advocated for both of these. So holism is the idea that social structures or social entities operate according to their own rules and laws. And there is no need, in fact, there is no possibility of determining the characteristics of the whole as a result of the characteristics of the parts. That social entities have a logic, a kind of emergent logic of their own, and so social science should study the whole rather than the parts. Structuralism likewise holds that features like the state, features like the economic system, that these features have structural characteristics which do not need to be reduced to or explained in terms of the features of individuals. As you know, the view that I argue for is one which rejects both the individualism of methodological individualism, but rejects also the holism of methodological holism. What I argue for is the microfoundations theory and the methodological localism theory. The idea that all social phenomena ultimately are embodied in the activities of individuals within social networks, social relationships, social institutions. And so all social explanation ultimately needs to somehow be related to or grounded in a theory of those socially constructed individuals in specific social environments. These are all descriptions of the way in which we might think of the relationship between higher level and lower level. What is attractive, I think, about the methodological localism view is that it does not say there is no such thing as a social structure or there is no such thing as a social whole. Methodological localism does not say that. What it says instead is that the characteristics of the social whole must be understood in terms of the properties and actions and choices of individuals at the local level. And if we can do that, then we can talk freely and confidently about the higher level social structure. I've already, I think, now said enough about reductionism. This is, of course, in the notes, and so you would be able to kind of review what is the definition of reductionism, what is the difference. Actually, I will make a comment about particularism, but the reason for turning to particularism and local knowledge here is to notice that there are some social scientists who think that the only thing that can be studied is the local. And here I'm thinking of some anthropologists like Clifford Geertz, who basically put it forward that social knowledge has to do with identifying the very specific features of this village, this set of relationships. In other words, they are unwilling to climb up to the higher level. I offer my own view that that is really not a satisfactory understanding of the social sciences, largely because the local is always influenced by more distant circumstances. So if we're thinking of a Balinese fishing village, there are local relationships in the village, but there are also distant trading relationships. The WTO is underway. There are governmental organizations. In other words, to restrict ourselves only to the local, not rising to the higher levels, is to miss an important form of social causation. Holism, the view that there are social facts that govern individuals, and I've indicated my reasons for thinking that's not justified. Structuralism is the view that social structures like states, markets, and kinship systems have causal properties which are independent of individuals. The idea that large structures like the state exert autonomous social influence. The kind of statement that I'm thinking of is the one that says the capitalist state regulates individual behavior. Well, from my point of view, that is what I refer to in a minute as reification, because the capitalist state doesn't directly have causal powers. Rather, it has agencies, it has individuals, it has police powers. In other words, we need to break down the causal effectiveness of the capitalist state, or we need to provide methodological localist foundations. Supervenience theory, this gives a little bit more of an explanation of what supervenience theory is. It also refers, if you are interested in learning more about supervenience theory, you can turn to the writings of Jagwon Kim, who is an American philosopher of science and whose books are referred to in the bibliography. So, it's not a surprise to you that the view that I would advocate on this question of levels is the view of methodological localism. It's a view that permits us to talk about higher level social entities, but it requires that the causal properties, the causal effectiveness of those higher level social institutions must be understood in terms of the way that the micro foundations work at the level of the socially situated individual. Now we're turning to a different subject, and one which, again, I find a very intriguing subject. But it's, and maybe this title is not the best title, it's the topic of social ontology. What kinds of things exist? What kinds of social things exist? And it's the, where I find it intriguing is to ask the question, does the state exist? Does the state exist? Does feudalism exist? Does capitalism exist? Does communism exist? Each of these terms, state, feudalism, capitalism, communism, each of those is a very high-level term referring to, or apparently referring to, a complicated set of social structures. But the question that I have found intriguing to dig into is the question, what would be involved in our being able to say there is such a thing as feudalism in the world? And it's found in many places. It's found in France in 1200. It's found in Japan in 1800. What would be involved in asserting that there is such a thing as feudalism? And what I put forward is that there would have to be something like an essence to feudal organization. There would have to be a kind of an essential defining list of properties which social arrangements possess, in virtue of which they are defined as being feudal. And what I find in my understanding of history is that there are very few, if any, large-scale social structures which are uniform in that way. So if you were to compare, for example, European or French feudalism in 1400, let's say, the feudalism of France, with the so-called feudalism of Japan, you would find there are some features in common. So ownership by a lord, serfs who are obligated to work some kind of military significance of the feudal order, and yet there are also significant differences. So in other words, what I want to put forward is that these high-level terms are useful as a way of focusing our thinking, but we shouldn't think that they serve to identify specific social entities. Instead, they are more like what Weber refers to, that's Max Weber, as ideal type concepts. They are concepts which single out certain features which we can focus on and analyze, and then we can recognize some of those features are found in other social orders. But then if we ask the question, European versus Japanese feudalism, what we should be looking for is difference as much as similarity. So terms like feudalism, revolution, industrialization, these terms should be understood, here's a philosophical term, nominalistically rather than essentialist or realist. And I should explain what that distinction means. A nominalist term is a term which merely verbally characterizes, verbally captures, verbally singles out certain things for the purpose of investigation. An essentialist term identifies a characteristic that is real in the world. And I'd like to give you an example from the natural sciences. The term metal is a realistic term because it refers to all of those physical structures which have the properties of a metal. So crystalline, lattice kind of structure, free electrons, conductivity, the characteristics, in other words, of metals, those characteristics obtain across gold, iron, copper, other metals. And so we can understand the term metal as realistically identifying a physical property which is found across instances. A nominalist term would be maybe the example of a happy family, where we might say we have some idea of what we mean by a happy family, but we don't actually think that there is a rigid distinction between the happy families and the unhappy families. And we also don't think that there is one set of characteristics in common among all of the happy families. So the purpose of a nominalistic term, or a term like feudalism or happy family, those terms serve to pick out historical instances for study, and then lead our attention to looking for both similarities across cases and also differences across cases. So I would like to put it forward that we can refer with confidence to existing social institutions. We can refer, for example, to the existing Chinese state and bureaucracy. That refers to a particular kind of open-ended set of networks and institutions and organizations existing today, existing yesterday, will exist tomorrow. And likewise, we can refer to the American state, and we can refer to particular embodied institutions in many different historical settings. So I would put it forward, we can be realist. We can say the Chinese state does in fact refer to something real, a set of real social institutions and relationships. But we are, I think, best advised to look at the term state in general as being merely nominalistic or ideotypical. That in other words, there's no essential state that is found in the many different instances of states. So states at the concrete level, these we can say these things really exist, but the state in general, we can say, does not really exist. Reification is the logical error or the fallacy that we might be drawn into, the fallacy of using the term the state and then presuming that there is some single set of causal properties which states always have. I like to think of the contrast between the French absolutist state the theater state that Clifford Geertz describes in Bali, and the Chinese imperial state. They all serve political functions, but the organization, the institutions, the way in which power is used within each of those institutions are radically different. And yet, if we were to say there is a state in every one of those cases, therefore there should be a set of causal properties that are similar, that is the error of reification. That is to assume causal similarity simply because there is a verbal similarity. So there is a kind of methodological consequence for the social scientist. The consequence is that we should be looking to the particular institutional configuration rather than the general theory of the type of thing we're looking at. So if we're interested, for example, in labor unions, we should not, you know, kind of have a general theory of what a labor union is. We should rather look to the specific ways in which labor organizations have been implemented in France, in China, in Japan, in the United States, and we should notice that there are some important similarities, there are some important differences, and there is no single thing which could be referred to as a labor union. Okay. Another large topic is the, I refer to the topic as naturalism, but it is really the question, what is the relationship between the social sciences and the natural sciences? And it is the answer to that question which says social science research and theory should resemble natural science research and theory. So naturalism is the view that the social sciences, if they're any good at all, should have the same logical characteristics as the natural sciences. And therefore, according to the naturalists, I disagree with this view. I hope I've made that clear earlier on. But as a consequence, social science, according to this view, should consist of general, comprehensive theories of social phenomena, should be offering hypotheses about the most general characteristics of the social order. Social sciences should be looking for exceptionless generalizations about social phenomena across groups and across societies, should be looking for natural kinds of social phenomena, types of social phenomena that always have the same properties. These are the objectives that social science should have if the social sciences are to be successful examples of scientific, i.e. natural scientific explanation. But in fact, I believe that this is a profoundly misleading analogy for the social sciences. Misleading in the way that but it's really harmful to have the wrong example out in front of you. If you thought that the social sciences should look an awful lot like Mahjong, like, you know, a game, a board game of some sort, if that's what you thought, you would then go about constructing your theory and your research activity to resemble the activity of the board game. And yet, it's a bad example, and therefore, you would lead to bad social science research and explanation. That's really what I'm saying about naturalism, that naturalism is not the right model for understanding social phenomena. And if we force ourselves into the naturalistic way of understanding the social sciences, then we will be led away from the formulation of good research, good theories, good explanations. We will be led away from good social science. What are some of these problems with naturalism? Well, social phenomena are in fact not similar to natural phenomena in a couple of different ways. Individuals are not similar to atoms or molecules. Individuals are agents. That was the purpose of my talking about deliberative agency last time. Individuals are reflective. They make choices. They consider. They have beliefs, and their behavior is, to some extent, self-driven, which is different in kind from the way in which an electron or an atom behaves. An atom is not a self-conscious, self-directing entity. But likewise, social structures are not similar to natural structures. Even relatively stable social structures, like a property system, the property system is created and embodied by the individuals and their powers over an extended period of time. And a property system can change. It can change through legislation, it can change through collective action, it can change through quiet forms of resistance we talked about last time. In other words, a property system can be changed by the behavior of individuals who occupy positions in the property system. And therefore, the social structure of a property system is completely unlike a chemical compound which has absolutely fixed and eternal characteristics. So there is a plasticity to social structures which is not found in natural structures. And analogously, or maybe following from that point, social regularities are not analogous to laws of nature. There are social regularities. We can find them. It's valuable to discover social regularities. But they are weak or soft regularities. They are not exceptionless, and they are not eternal. And we have really good reason to believe that they would not be either exceptionless or eternal. Why is that? Well, it's because social regularities derive from the interaction between individuals, their states of agency, and the institutional setting in which they find themselves. But we've already argued that individuals are somewhat plastic. Their ideas and frameworks change over time, and institutions are plastic. And therefore, we would expect that regularities would be very soft and changeable over time, social regularities. There's an example, a slightly silly example that I offer in the essay, which I think I offered only as an extra reading for you, on the scope and limits of generalizations in the social sciences. But in that essay, I describe a regularity, and that regularity is that hand tools, the tools that people use, are almost always less than 40 pounds in weight. Hand tools are almost always less than 40 pounds in weight. A hammer, never more than 40 pounds. A screwdriver, never more than 40 pounds. Well, is that a deep fact about the world, or is it a fact about human purpose and human strength? Having a 400-pound mallet is just a dumb idea, because no human being could lift a 400-pound mallet. In other words, the regularity about hand tools we can understand perfectly well in terms of our theory of socially situated human individuals with their characteristics, their physical characteristics of strength, and their purposes in designing hand tools. Well, I put it forward to you that that's not a bad instance of social generalization. It's also a generalization that could change over time. So if, for example, with better nutrition, people get stronger, it may well be that hammer weight gets bigger, gets higher over time. You get bigger hammers as a result. That's very possible. It's also possible that as the circumstances of cooperation change, as human society becomes more complex and there's more social cooperation, it may be that tools also get more complex. In other words, the interaction between human beings, their social institutions, and their material culture, it's a complicated, many-sided interaction. There will be some generalizations that obtain there, but there will also be plasticity and change over time. Here I'm simply summarizing what I take to be the important differences between social phenomena and natural phenomena. By the way, probably a little bit of a qualification or a kind of a comment should be made here. There are people who very much agree with this view that natural sciences are a bad analogy, because social science is inherently subjective, that it has essentially to do with the qualitative states of mind of individuals, and therefore we should interpret, but we should not give causal explanation. That is called the Verstehen approach to social science. It is the interpretive approach. My criticisms of naturalism do not reduced to lining up with the Verstehen approach. This is a German word that means basically understanding. The anti-naturalist view, which says the social sciences must be interpretative, I understand that view, but it's not the view that I'm putting forward. I'm putting forward a view that says causal explanation is the right kind of explanation in the social sciences, but it's causal explanation that works through human agency. The understanding of human motivation is one important piece of that, but it's only one important piece. In other words, I'm putting forward a theory of the social sciences which is materialistic and causal, but anti-naturalistic. We can now turn to one final topic, and that is the topic of objectivity, evidence, methodology, inference, and the way in which empirical research relates to or pertains to the evaluation of social science theory. Right at the beginning of our lectures, we asked the question, what is a social science? And we've spent most of our time focusing on the question of explanation. We've said that sciences explain things, and then we've kind of dug into, we have further investigated what is a good social explanation. And we've gone down that road of talking about causal explanation, talking about institutions, talking about rational choice and micro-foundations. So we've answered one piece of the question, what is a good social science? It is a body of thought which permits rigorous explanation. But another major part of the answer, what is science, has to do with empirical investigation. And so in this last couple of minutes, I want to talk about the role of empirical justification in the social sciences. And the question here is really, how do we evaluate, how do we test, how do we justify the theories that we put forward under the heading of social science theories? How do we use empirical methods? How do we use empirical data to justify and evaluate the theories that we put forward? Empiricism is the philosophical theory which says that knowledge must be justified by empirical evidence, that there is no other source of knowledge about the world beyond empirical evidence. And what this is inconsistent with is the idea that we can derive social facts from pure philosophy, for example. If pure reasoning could tell us, here is how the Chinese state works, well, that would be great. We wouldn't have to bother with empirical investigation, but regrettably, that isn't how knowledge works. Instead, we have to observe the world, we have to gather evidence, and we have to then evaluate our theories on the basis of the evidence which we consider. A couple of authors whose work is especially relevant to the question of empirical evaluation of theory. One is Karl Popper, an English-Polish philosopher of science, who introduced the idea of falsifiability. He asserts that scientific theories are confirmed not by simply bringing a lot of evidence which supports them, because it's his view, we can always find evidence that supports a theory. Instead, it's more complicated than that. It is when we put forward the theory, we should look diligently for evidence that would falsify the theory. We should be looking all the time for the test that would show us that our theory is incorrect, that it's wrong, that it is untrue. In other words, Popper asserts that the scientific approach to the world is a deeply critical approach. It says, I will test my theories and my hypotheses as hard as I can. And then Popper asserts that the theories which survive over time, the theories which are not falsified, those theories we have some reason to have rational confidence in. So that's one theory of justification we could be concerned about. An application might be that if, and in fact, Popper makes this application to Marxism, Popper says, Marx, he says it incorrectly, by the way, but he says of Karl Marx, Marx believed he had a theory of all of capitalism which had predictive consequences. Marx loaded on all kinds of confirming empirical data, but therefore Marx was not a scientist, because Marx did not try to disconfirm his theory. He did not try to find those historical evidence, bodies of evidence, which would show his theory was incorrect. And so Popper is a big critic of Marx. He's also a big critic of Freud. He says both Marx and Freud have theories which are very flexible and which can be accommodated to any observation, whereas good science has hard, specific predictions which can be falsified, which can be tested and shown to be incorrect. Carl Hempel is an American philosopher of science who is also interested in the question, how do we confirm, how do we justify scientific theories? His view is a more traditional view. His view is that the way that we confirm a scientific theory is that we test its consequences. We perform experiments. And so if our theory is that, this is a bad example because we can't do this experiment, but if our theory is that the production of CO2 causes global warming, that's a theory. And the theory of confirmation would say, what we need to do is to find some ways of taking that theoretical premise, deriving consequences, new consequences, and then testing to see whether those consequences are true. And maybe my example is not so bad, because we could do an experiment with, for example, I don't know if you've heard about this laboratory in the United States, in the desert in the United States, but it's a glass-covered, several hectare area called Biosphere. So it's covered with glass and it has a complete ecology within it. It has plants, it has people living in it, animals, people growing corn. And the idea was they would live there for 2 years in Biosphere, and it would allow us to evaluate various hypotheses. Well, one thing that could be done is to put more and more CO2 into that environment and then see what happens to the temperature. That would be a way of testing the CO2 hypothesis. And what Carl Hempel asserts is that scientific theories typically cannot be directly confirmed or falsified. Rather, we have to confirm them or falsify them by evaluating their logical consequences, forming either observations or experiments, and then either accepting or rejecting the theory accordingly. I also have a criticism of this theory of confirmation for the social sciences. It kind of corresponds to the debate that I have with naturalism, because this is a good theory for evaluating the fundamental hypotheses of physics, quantum mechanics, let's say. You can't go out and examine quantum mechanics. You can't test or evaluate fundamental physics in a piecemeal way. This hypothesis is true, that one is false, this one is true. And therefore, we're forced to the form of confirmation, the form of experimentation that Hempel describes. I argue, though, that social science research is different from that. It's different because its hypotheses are generally not highly abstract, highly hypothetical. Rather, the hypotheses of the social sciences are usually kind of what you could call middle-level hypotheses. They're hypotheses which can be directly evaluated and tested. Take the one that we talked about last time, the Mansur-Olson theory of collective action, the collective action problem. The theory says that groups with shared interests that are large, diffuse groups that have shared interests will generally fail to achieve their collective purposes. And he offers an economist's rational choice demonstration of that view. Well, that's a theory that we can test. We can go to various instances of possible group activity, and then we can evaluate the degree to which the group succeeds in pursuing its collective interest. We can evaluate the assumptions of neoclassical economics. We can do what is called experimental economics, and we can take college students and we can offer them to play games with us, game theory games, and we can observe their behavior and see whether they behave as rational agents or if they behave in some other way. In other words, the point I'm getting at is that social science hypotheses usually are not highly esoteric, highly unobservable. Rather, they're the kind of thing that our colleagues in the sociology department can go out and do concrete investigation, examine some cases, and then come to an evaluation. Here is the range of applicability of the hypothesis in question. In other words, I would disagree with Hempel in his assertion that the only way to evaluate scientific theories is through their aggregate consequences. I would say instead, in the social sciences, we often evaluate social science theories piecemeal. We take them apart and we examine the hypotheses and the perspectives separately, and we come to see, you know, they're maybe approximately true, but here are the qualifications. In other words, we come to a richer understanding of the scope and limits of the truth or the correctness of the various theories. Imre Lakatos, I mentioned him because he also has been very influential. He's a Hungarian philosopher of social science who basically said the task of justification, the way in which we come to determine whether a theory is a good theory or a bad theory, is not even directly through test of the theory. It's rather, is the theory supporting new explanatory successful scientific research? That's what he refers to as a progressive research program. So the question is, let's take neoclassical economics, let's take Verstehen sociology, let's take Marxism, and then ask the question, are these theories leading to progressive new empirical research? And if they are, that is indirectly a reason to think that they are approximately true. So what Lakatos is mostly focusing on is the fruitfulness of the research which follows from a research tradition. Rather than research program, you could think research tradition. It's a set of assumptions about kind of explanation and how things work, and we could then evaluate theories according to how fruitfully they suggest and propose new work. What about objectivity? Is social science objective? Well, this is an important question, and it breaks down into a couple of different questions. One, are there objective reasons for saying this theory is true and that theory is false? And for the reasons I've just been describing, I think that there are, that social science is objective in the sense that social scientists can use empirical observation, research, local research, high-level research, the gathering of social data, they can use those sources to give rational justification for the theories which they put forward, and therefore, on the first form of objectivity, I would say the social sciences have the capacity to be objective. The other kind of objectivity has to do with the fact that human behavior is subjective. It has to do with the subject. It has to do with choice. And so some people have said, because the object of social science investigation is subjective behavior, therefore the science can't be objective. And that, I think, is just a misunderstanding of the terms. I think we can objectively investigate social identities, for example. A social identity is a subjective state of mind, but we can objectively investigate that by doing interviews, by observing behavior. So an objective investigation of subjective social phenomena is no contradiction at all. So what objectivity requires is that the scientist be capable of providing rational and convincing justifications for the hypotheses that he or she puts forward, and we need to have reason for believing that those hypotheses are approximately true. The one other way in which people have talked about objectivity is to say that social science research is not objective in a third sense. It's not objective because social scientists themselves are inherently biased, that the social scientist always brings a set of presuppositions, and therefore he or she will never truly understand the social world because she always comes with a set of biases and perspectives. If you could imagine social science proceeding through the American White House, it's a terrible thought, really, to think that the George Bush administration would be determining how social science research is done. And yet, if you did think of that, then you would think it's going to be pretty biased research, because you probably know all the different ways the White House has tried to influence environmental science and reproductive science. They've basically tried to constrain the way that scientists can investigate. If that were the only kind of scientific research that occurred, I would then say social science research is inherently biased. Fortunately, in good universities, of which Peking University is one, in good universities, scholars are independent of the state, independent of political pressure, and therefore are able to look at and examine the phenomena that they're concerned with fresh eyes. And I think I will not discuss these couple of slides. This is kind of a conclusion, not only for today, but also for the previous three lectures on philosophy of social science. What I want to assert here is that social inquiry is not naturalistic. It is inexact. And that's not because social science methods are inexact. It's because the social science world, the social world, is inherently changeable, flexible, plastic, influenced by individuals, influenced by choice. Therefore, social inquiry is a conjunction of inexactness and intelligibility. That's the point about explanation, that we are, in fact, able to explain social outcomes by referring to causal mechanisms and social institutions. So explanation is possible, but the social world is not a closed, determined system of variables and outcomes. So there is scientific social inquiry. There are limits on the scope of social theories. Limits on scope, by which I would mean to say we shouldn't look for a single theory which explains everything. We shouldn't look for a single economic theory which explains Chinese economic development, Brazilian economic development. We should rather understand there will be locally important differences in the institutional setting and the human behavior. Therefore, one theory will not fit all the cases. We need to recognize that there is a multiplicity of questions and answers that can be posed to the social world, that there is huge contingency in social and historical causation, that the social world, once we understand it correctly, given the interaction between individuals, their social development, their identities, and the institutions that they both live within and they create and sustain, once we understand that complicated mix, we will also understand that there is tremendous contingency in social and historical development. Furthermore, that there's no single type of cause. Rather, there are interacting causes, environmental issues, facts about institutions, facts about the cultivation of human intelligence. All of these mean that there are multiple kinds of causes leading to historical and social outcomes. We have to emphasize I believe we need to emphasize the plasticity and kind of locally situatedness of social structures and entities. And I also suggest that we should look at a middle level of social structure rather than the most general level. I pick out this is from Clifford Geertz's book, Megara, the Theater State, and it's his abstract diagram of an irrigation system. And I took it out as being maybe just a little bit of a humorous illustration of how the social sciences might be overly exact. Okay, well, that was lecture number 4.